All right. The recorder is running.
Do you need to go catch it?
Oh, yeah, maybe I should.
You know, I'll bring it back.
Okay, will do. Welcome, warrior. You are listening to Bound by Honor, the Klingon Assault Group Book Review Podcast. Your hosts, Jorn Sutai Vampyr and Jajim Vestai Jajim, will explore Klingon culture as it appears in Star Trek literature. Perhaps you yourself can hear the cry of your inner warrior. If so, go to www.kag.org and make your presence known. Learn how to join the Klingon Assault Group and begin your journey along the way of the warrior. Now, here are your hosts, Kapla. Welcome to Bound by Honor, the Klingon Book Review Podcast. I am Jajim.
And I am Jorn.
And we are going to be looking at Gorkon, another Gorkon book called A Burning House by Keith R.A. DeCanido, published in February of 2008. And John, why don't you give us a brief summary of the plot?
Again, from the back of the book, they have been the Federation's staunchest allies and its fiercest adversaries. Cunning, ruthless, driven by an instinct for violence, and defined by a complex code of honor, they must push ever outward in order to survive, defying the icy ravages of space with the fire of their hearts. They are Klingons. And if you think you already know all there is to learn about them, think again. From its highest echelons of power to the shocking depths of its lowest castes, savagely aggressive military to its humble farmers. From political machinations of galactic import to personal demons and family strife, the Klingon Empire is revealed as never before when the captain and crew of the IKS Gorkon finally return to their home world of Kronos in a sweeping tale of intrigue, love, betrayal, and honor.
Okay, well, for that second part, I'll tell you what, that is a great summary for what we have in this book. I mean, it just stretches out all over the place.
And the first part almost reads like History of the Roman Empire.
I was thinking that very same thing. That's really neat. So, you know, I thought for this book, we would approach this more looking at each individual tale that comes through in this book. It is a collection of stories from several points of view, different things happening with different people on the ship. So first of all, let's start with your overall impressions and then mine, and then we'll jump into this.
To give people a handle on what's going on here, when the ship comes back to Kronos, everybody kind of goes their own separate ways for a while because the ship has to be refurbished. So you have a whole lot of different stories going on as these people are going about their separate ways and having different interactions. So this book is not a single story. It's not a straightforward plot line. You know, you're going to get different feelings. You're going to get different tastes of Klingon culture as you go through it. Tort, you know, the first officer of the Gorkon now, basically goes back to the planet where he had been held captive since he was born until around 18 years of age, and sees what has happened to his people and rescues Ba'el, who's like the last one left to be rescued. Wohl, leader Wohl, and friends go to a farm of Brek Kagak for the Yupta Yumma feast. Apparently it's a feast of a plentiful harvest, and experiences what it's like to be what it's like to live like a farmer. I don't know how far back you guys have gone in the series or whether you've read it. Wall was not a lowlife when she came into, well, when she came into the Defense Force, she was, because she was kicked out of her house. But she originally was raised as a highborn lady. So farm life, a farming community, the camaraderie of a farming table is something she's never experienced. So this is all new to her. And then the adventures that go on within the family follow from that. Gathaw goes home to what's considered to be a squalid city of Krenla and finds that his sister is involved in an opera based on what happened with them, the children of Sunhatara and General Talek, and finds they've gotten it all wrong, but doesn't know what to do about it. Kern gets his memory back. Uh-oh, problems there. But Orok attends a medical conference that nobody else at the conference wants to be at, and no one wants to hear what she's going to say, and only shows up to mock and ridicule her. Not a fun time. The engineer of the Gorkon, Kurak, is finally given control of her house. The last person who has been keeping her in the Defense Force has finally died, and she can replace him. So it's all about her trying to make the decision with Lessig as to whether or not she wants to stay in the Defense Force or begin running her house. All the while all this is happening, Clegg and Barak are getting together, and Leskit and Kurak have decided they're Parmak Kai.
Those are all the story threads. My overall impressions is I loved reading this book again because I had forgotten a lot of what took place. There is something for everyone in this collection of stories. Each one, it could have been its own short story, but I like the way everything came together at the end. It was great how Keith had Martok handing out justice at the end of everybody's story. The inclusion of the two epilogues at the end of this story left things wide open for new stories, one of them featuring Worf and Bael, who, well, we'll talk about them in a little bit, and one with Kern, and he has no place left to go, and apparently he's being checked on by the Imperial Intelligence, perhaps, to become an agent of some kind. I sure hope these stories can be written in the future.
Well, I think we talked with Keith a few episodes ago about this, because it seemed kind of abrupt that this whole series just kind of died. It was a fascinating series, and it had a lot of places that it could go. But apparently the editors and his publisher decided no, and thus ended the Tales of the Gorkon.
Well, at least now, up till now. Who knows what could happen in the future? It could go anywhere. Keith also said that he dearly loved writing these stories. He really enjoyed writing them, liked the characters a lot, so I'm going to hold out hope. So I thought a good way to approach this may be to just look at each segment individually before we get to an end. And I think let's start with Borok, who is attending a medical conference. She seems to be really up for it, but nobody else seems to be very excited to be there. She is supposed to talk about how she replaced Clag's arm, which, of course, as we know from past books, is not a very popular subject among Klingons, and it's also not very popular amongst Klingon doctors.
No, they had to, for most of the conferences, I recall, you were basically dragging the doctors to the conference. One or two maybe were there to listen to whatever speaker was going on, until you got to her talk on the arm replacement. Then the room was filled, but not because they wanted to hear her, but because they wanted to heckle her.
Yeah, and they did a great job. She finally finally wound up walking out of her own talk. One of the big concerns, and this was a kind of a confusing thing for me, one of the concerns that came from the audience during Borak's talk was the spirit of Clag's father still occupying the arm and how that was to be dealt with. And that gave me a moment of pause, because as I remember with Klingon religion, once the spirit has left the body, it's just an empty shell to be simply discarded in whatever way that's convenient.
We established that in the first Klingon episode of The Next Generation.
And she says, you're better off talking to a cleric about that, because that's not my area. I am a doctor. I'm here to heal. And they're all very upset that she's been trained in Federation medicine, and she's trying to improve Klingon medicine by bringing techniques into the Empire, and she's not going to be accepted. It just doesn't look like it's going to happen. Even though she has the backing of Chancellor Martok to do so.
Well, I think if you want to look at it from their point of view, she's not trying to bring the benefits of Federation technology to Klingon medicine. She's trying to impose Federation techniques on Klingons.
Well, and to the benefit of the Empire, because she realizes that if you heal a warrior, they can go back into battle. But if you have a warrior who can't be healed, the only option is to kill them, and a dead warrior isn't going to do you any good.
In fact, the Children of Santara picked up on what she was doing faster than the Klingons have. They liked the fact that she could patch up their warriors and send them back out into the field.
And in this story, the conference pretty well comes to an end when a shuttle crashes into a building very near there. And we get a whole different tack on this story. It moves in another direction where Borak has to treat victims of this crash, including the person piloting the shuttle. And then later on, we get an interesting reveal on that in the final conference with Martok. That's kind of how that story goes. And then, of course, there's a little side story with Borak as she seems to be sparking with Clag.
Yeah, that began at the beginning of the book, I think, and then works its way all the way through. I don't have a clear view of it, but didn't she have to fight like Hades to get some testing material to find out what was going on in that accident?
No, what she had to fight for was being able to actually examine the body, because she was told...
Yeah, looking for evidence.
Yeah, she was told she had to return that body immediately to the Empire. She had it beamed up to to the Gorkons, so she could use her own medical bay, which is advanced, in order to find out the reason what happened with this pilot. And so that gets resolved at the end. I want to save that to sum it up at the end.
Well, I do want to say one thing, though, here about the facilities that she's got on the Gorkon. It was stated in the original series of Star Trek that there's very little that a base facility can do that a starship can't. So her equipment on the Gorkon should be better than what's available on Kronos. Number one, because of who she is and what she's going to get and what she's going to have. But number two, it's a Klingon starship, and it should have the best equipment that's available.
Yeah, she has seen to that. So let's talk about talk.
Talking talk, huh?
Yeah, see what I did there? All right. So anyway, the camp on Korea, where Tok was raised and where the Romulans and Klingons went to after the Battle of Kittimer, has been destroyed. It's all been leveled and almost everyone has been killed. And Tok goes back to see what is left and who is left. He wants to find survivors and see if he can help out somehow. And he does find survivors. He finds Bael and the Romulan in charge of the camp, Tokoth,
who just happens to be Bael's father.
And Bael's mother apparently has taken her own life, and everybody else in the camp is dead. However, they're missing Lakor, and find out that Lakor has been taken by Granik off to another place, and he is torturing Lakor. Tok, Bael, and Tokoth arrive on the scene to rescue Lakor, and a phaser battle breaks out between them. Tokoth is killed by Granik's defense system. Bael and Tok kill Granik, and then the two of them leave by themselves to head back for Kronos. And when Bael gets back to Kronos, when the two of them, Tok and Bael, get back to Kronos, Bael doesn't know what to do with herself. She doesn't belong there. Korea has been the only place she has known as home. And Tok tells her to go talk to Worf, who is the ambassador. And then Tok goes off on his own to find the person who raised him on Kronos. So at any rate, Bael winds up talking to Worf, and she is still enamored with him.
But I don't think as enamored, wasn't it? I think it was kind of fading a bit.
Yeah, it was more of a nostalgic thing until she got into his presence, and then she actually thought she may have a chance to rekindle the relationship that they started on Korea. But Worf was being very standoffish, and then she noticed Kalar, a picture of Kalar and Alexander on Worf's wall, and also Jadzia. And Worf told her about them, but she's still holding a torch for Worf at the end of this thing. He finds her a job in the embassy, and she's going to be assistant to someone who arranges state functions like big dinners and things like that. And so she has a job, and she's on Kronos, and she's looking forward at the end of her story to learning more about her heritage.
And importantly, that job is of a scope that she deals with different races, not just Klingons, because that was the big problem. Her being accepted in Klingon society, being half Romulan.
Tok learns the truth of what happened at Kittimer and why the Romulans attacked Kittimer during that conference, which caused the death of a lot of people, and why the camp was started by Tokoth, and why Lakor agreed and they decided to, you know, live in peace. So let's move on to Kurak, the engineer of the Gorkon, and her story.
Well, the caretaker of the Gintok of the of her house finally ups and dies as she gets back, and that leaves her as the head of the household and able to appoint a new caretaker for the house, one that is more to her liking, but more importantly, one who is not going to enforce the "someone of this house must be always in the defense force" that she had been railing against all of her time through all of the Gorkon books.
Okay, and even before that, it was a very interesting story, because Leskett talked her into going down to the planet, and then accompanying her to a restaurant, a Vulcan restaurant, which she didn't think she was going to like at all. She was just not happy about this at all. Leskett convinced her to give it a shot, and she liked the cuisine, the Vulcan cuisine. It was very well prepared. They knew Leskett in this place because apparently he's a regular customer. Now, while they're sitting down to dinner, Kurak gets it into her head that her and Leskett should become mates. And Leskett explains to her, look, I am not going to abandon my wife and my son. I cannot do this. That would be dishonorable. And there's just no right way this is going to do this. So you and I are going to remain the way we are now. And I am going to continue to take care of my family. I'm not going to orphan them. So Kurak, she's seems to be just ready to accept this. And then what you said happened was how Maloj died, the Gintok of her house died. She got special dispensation at the end from Martok to be the head of her house, which of course Martok thinks that is archaic and ridiculous and would like to get it changed anyway. But he gives her a special dispensation to be the head of her house. She appoints a new Gintok, which happens to be Leskett's wife, who divorces Leskett so he and Kurak can be mated. I don't know about you, but I think that's really convoluted.
Nah, could be worse. You could have a Ferengi in charge of the house.
Where have we seen that before? Anyway, it seems very convenient because Leskett can still take care of his family and he can still be mated to Kurak. Everything's tied up in a neat little bow and set aside and everything's great. Gajoth, I feel sorry for this guy. He went home to Krenla. He was a little reluctant to do so at the beginning, but he went ahead to go and see how his family was doing. And he was not happy with what he found there.
Well, first of all, Krenla is not the best community on Kronos. They keep stressing that over and over again. So he's going in not expecting a lot from his family because of him growing up there. And then to find they're staging an opera based on his exploits. Well, his ship's exploits with the children of Santara. And his sister is involved with the chorus, schnammered with the lead actor who's not playing Clag, but playing the general who's caused all the problems for Clag on this planet. And they're not getting the story right.
Yeah, there's a lot of details. They actually ask Gajoth to come in as a technical advisor, but they don't take his advice.
At all.
And he tries to explain to them, you know, this is not realistic and this is not the way it should be and nobody's going to believe this. And they keep telling him it'll be fine. Okay, this is the way we've been doing it for years and years, and Gajoth is just not buying it. He goes home to his family, sits down for dinner with them, and he thinks everything is just fine with his family. But later on, he finds out that his father has lost his business and his sister is involved romantically with the lead actor or the lead singer in this opera, a guy named Kenny, who has a whole string of these relationships that he picks up with them and then he dumps them and goes on to somebody else. Gajoth walks the streets of his city and he sees police officers abusing children and his boyhood best friends don't want anything to do with him because they're all poor. And he learns that the town, Krenla, is depressed because they are not contributing anything to the Empire, so the Empire is not contributing anything to them. And it's just a place that he wants to be away from, as far away as he can get.
In fact, I think those three kids that the officers are accosting, he decides to intervene on their behalf. And when they notice, when the officers notice that he's a member of the defense force, they start giving him all kinds of deference and allow him to do what he wants to do, like he's a special breed of person, which is different from how everybody else is treated in this particular sector of the city he's in. He tries to help the kids out. Like you said, the kids were the kids of his former friends, and his former friends don't want to have anything to do with him or doesn't want him to help their kids out, because all hope for these people are gone.
Yeah, well, his friend tells him, yeah, that's great. When your ship is repaired, you're going to go back to the Gorkon and take off back out into space, and we're still stuck here, and we also have to put up with the consequences of what you've done. So Gajoth finds these three kids playing in the street. The officer, with a pain stick, wants them to go away, and Gajoth imposes on their behalf. And what happens to them? As soon as Gajoth is gone, these kids get beat up. And I mean, they're just kids. And they get beat up pretty badly. And it's like Gajoth's friend just says, leave us alone. Don't help, because it's not actually going to help us. It's going to hurt us.
No, you know the police were going to retaliate as soon as he was gone.
And it's really a sad situation, a place on Kronos that is totally depressed and not a place you would want to be. However, despite all the problems that Gajoth had with the opera, it turned out to be a huge success,
including Worf and Martok attending it.
What was the guy? The guy said half of Kronos is here to watch this opera. And do you remember how opera fans show their appreciation for a good performance?
Don't they throw things?
They throw their drinks on the stage. They coat the stage with blood wine at the end of the opera to show their appreciation of it, which is just kind of the opposite of the way it was in the 19th century and 18th century over in Europe, where the only time people would throw things at the stage was when the opera was bad. Kind of an interesting opposite there.
And like you said, he has to deal with his sister being rejected by the lead singer, having her hopes for a career in the opera dashed, knowing that the best she got from this one was the chorus.
Well, she still has a future, because Gajoth restrained himself from killing Kenny, which is what he actually really wanted to do, but he knew that it would make things worse for his sister. And he can't do that because she is the sole income of the house.
Yep. It's the final reinforcement, final nail in the coffin to his desire to go in and make things better, because he realizes at that point anything that he does will be undone the minute he leaves.
So, and Gajoth is also connected to Leader Wohl's story, because the Gorkon goes in for repairs. It's hanging there in space. There's no place for Wohl to go. She doesn't belong anywhere. So she's planning to just stay on the ship, which I guess is she's not supposed to, because all she's going to be is in the way of the workers that are working on the ship. So she has to go somewhere. Okay. So one of her Beks, Kagak, says, you can come to our house and hang out with us. And Goron, he takes Kagak up on that. And Wohl is like, no, I'm not going to do this. I'm not going to impose on your family. And Gajoth finally talks her into going. And they do go. So you have Wohl, Kagak, and Goron headed for Fabian 3 for the Yopta Yupma harvest feast, kind of like a fall festival.
A new holiday Keith gives us in the Klingon calendar.
Yeah, and apparently it is celebrated empire-wide from what I could understand.
That's what it seems to be, because it's referred to in the same book, but in another location.
So they get to Fabian 3, they get off the shuttle, they get on a car or a ground vehicle, which is apparently something that Wohl did not want anything to do with, and they go for a very long drive over very rough terrain. And she doesn't enjoy this, and she is already thinking about Kagak. I'm going to kill Kagak for getting me into this. Why am I here?
Well, if you're used to really good transportation, bumping along country roads, and that's what these were described as, is not a pleasant experience. The only thing worse would be if she was required to drive herself.
Well, yeah, and she wouldn't have found the place anyway, because from her point of view, it is out in the middle of nowhere at all. And
your typical farm.
Yeah, the crops are growing. She cannot, she doesn't even know where she is in relation to everything else on the planet, and they just pull up in front of this place, and the driver is named Furman, and apparently he is Kagak's brother, a big, clumsy farm boy who apparently is very, very strong. And the first thing that Wohl finds out is her uniform is not welcome at the farm.
And she hasn't brought any other clothes with her.
Well, apparently, according to what I read, she doesn't even own any.
Yeah, she doesn't even own any.
Yeah, and the reason for that is because the ground troops on board the Gorkon are allowed a very small space on the ship, and they can have whatever they can keep in that space and nothing else. So she has no civilian clothes. She has no need for civilian clothes. She's a warrior. She's going to be a warrior, so she doesn't need very much. So she winds up borrowing clothes from Kagak's sister, which is okay. And everything goes along just fine. But during this festival on Fabian 3, there apparently is a contest which is... basically involves combat, okay? And Furman is the guy that represents Kagak's family in this contest, but something doesn't go quite right, and Furman gets injured and can't fight, and there's nobody else to fight for the family.
Well, not only that, but the guy who's been winning the fight for the last 5 years... is not a member of the family.
No. The one that's winning the fight, apparently he is big. He's kind of slow, but if he hits you once, you're out of the contest. So Furman gets injured. Kagak is going to take over. He knows he doesn't have a chance. The family knows he doesn't have a chance, and they don't know what else to do. Well, Wohl, in the middle of the night, she hears a wedding ceremony going on, a Klingon oath taking for the ceremony, and she just kind of ignores it. It's very loud, but she manages to go back to sleep. When she gets up the next morning and they go to the festival for the fights, this guy defeats 1, 2, 3 opponents very easily, and then Kagak is supposed to get up there, and he's not even ready to go, and nobody knows who's going to fight for the family.
Now, it should also be mentioned at this point that the family who's been winning the fight year after year after year is living off the earnings that they're making, the winnings that they're getting off of this fight. So, in a lot of respects, to win this fight means your household will survive. The pickings for the rest of everybody else are not as strong as you would think for a standard farming community.
So they're getting ready for this fight, and steps forward for Kagak's family is none other than Goron himself. And there's a big argument. How can he fight for them? He's a Beck in the Defense Force. He can't fight. Well, come to find out that this wedding ceremony that Wohl heard was Goron becoming mates with Kagak's sister. So now he is part of the family, and he is eligible to compete, and he is huge. He is as big as the one that's been winning the contest for the past several years, and people get a little bit nervous about what's going to happen with this.
As they should, since it was one blow to the top of the other guy's head that drove him to the ground.
Indeed.
But that's Goron. We knew that, you know, when he got mega upset not being able to hold up that item 3 books ago.
Well, Goron, anyway, he walks in and cleans house. He takes care of business, wins, and everybody's happy, and everybody goes home, and the three of them head back, or get ready to head back for the Gorkon, and Wohl has found that she has had a very pleasant experience, way better than she thought it was, and she's also considered part of Kagak's family now, and of course Goron is, and she's looking forward to, all of them are looking forward to going back there again, and Gajoth wishes he had gone along too, after what he saw. So that was a kind of a happy story in this. There isn't much happiness going on with this.
Well, here's a thought. How many different marriage ceremonies are there in Klingon culture? The ritual that Goron and Kagak's sister goes through is the same ceremony that Worf was going to go through in the Next Generation. But then you have the marriage ceremony that he did go through with Jadzia, which was a whole lot more elaborate. It begs the question, A, how many ceremonies are there? How many different ways are there to tie the knot? And B, are there different levels of tying the knot in Klingon culture represented in the differences in ceremonies?
That would be something to research, I think. However, Worf and Jadzia's wedding was when Worf was part of the House of Martok. And, you know, perhaps there's more pomp when it's a high society kind of person getting wed, as opposed to, well, and that wouldn't hold either, because Kalar was an ambassador, and all they had to do was take the oath, and Worf was ready to do that, and Kalar said, no way, we're not going to take the oath, why don't we just call it what it is? It was fun, it was glorious, but not a reason to get married.
I mean, we have the same thing in our culture, in that you can have the big in-church elaborate ceremony, or you can just go to a Justice of the Peace, or even just go to Vegas. But is that the same type of thing? Or are there subtle meanings that we just don't know about? There's so much more about Klingon culture that these writers can experiment with and show us.
So, fill in the blanks for us there, you guys. We'd love to know this.
Write more books.
They're writing lots of books. The Star Trek book universe is very, very rich, and it's very, very good now. Now, here's the downer, the bummer, cloud that hangs over this book. And that
is... But Oryk wasn't bad enough?
No, because we have Kern, or Rodek, however you want to refer to him.
At what part of the book you're reading is it Kern or Rodek? You start out as Rodek, you end up as Kern.
Well, actually, you wind up as Rodek because, well, we'll explain it. So Rodek is beginning to get his memory back. This is really bothering him. He's beginning to get, I should say, Kern's memories back. This is bothering him. He doesn't understand why this is happening. So he goes to the goes to a doctor on Kronos because Borak is not available to him. And he goes to a doctor on Kronos who finds out that the injuries he has had do not account for having these earlier memories from Kern, and also informs him that his crest has actually been surgically altered for some reason that Rodek has no idea what happened. And so he decides he's going to go confront Bashir on Deep Space Nine and find out exactly what happened.
In fact, doesn't Dorek, Clagg's brother, hasn't he gotten involved at this point and is suggesting to Rodek that he should go talk to Bashir?
No, Rodek's not involved quite yet, but in a couple seconds he will be.
Dorek. Rodek, yeah. Is Kern.
Right. So Rodek heads to Deep Space Nine. He finds Bashir. Bashir examines him and doesn't really know what to do. So Rodek says, I'm going to go to the Klingon restaurant. You figure it out. Bashir gets a hold of Ezri for advice, and they both agree finally that Rodek needs to know the truth. They are going to go and they're going to go tell him the truth. However, also in the Klingon restaurant is Dorek, Clagg's brother, who sits down with Rodek and gives Rodek half-truths, but also elaborates on it, implicating that Clagg was also involved in the plot. And Rodek buys this story, gets up and leaves. He now knows that he was Kern from the House of Moog, Worf's brother. He leaves the place before Bashir and Ezri can come and explain to him what actually happened, and Rodek leaves. So Dorek follows, and Clegg, who has been at home, leaves for a meeting, comes back, and his mother is there cooking food. And Clegg's very happy because he was beginning to think that his mother was angry at him for discommodating Dorek. And she puts a plate in front of him, and Clegg passes out because he's been poisoned. Not to death, but he's been poisoned. Clegg wakes up and goes to a challenge, and here comes Rodek, challenges Clegg to a fight to the death because he thinks Clegg is involved with this. Worf shows up at the scene for this challenge and tells Rodek Kern that Clegg was not involved in this in any way. It was all me, Worf tells him. And so Kern takes off and leaves. Okay? Everybody else goes back to whatever they're doing.
As I recall, there was a bit of a fight that went on until Worf stopped it, so to speak. And somehow, didn't Clegg's mother and Dorek get taken into custody over this?
Oh, yeah, that's right. They were actually arrested and taken away to be investigated and find out what was going on. So, Kern has run away. Nobody knows where he's gone, except Worf has a pretty good idea. And Worf goes to the former land of the House of Moog. Of course, the house has been destroyed. All the buildings are destroyed. The land is just sitting there, and it has been sold to another person. And Kern is just sitting out in the middle of the property. He's not doing anything. He's not hurting anybody. And Worf shows up, and they talk. And Kern is not happy about what has happened to him. He tells Worf that the only time he has been happy in his life is as Rodek. And so therefore, he is going to go on being Rodek. He's going to go back to the Gorkon, remain as second officer, and continue his life the way it is. And he is not going to, he's no longer going to be Kern. He doesn't want to change his crest. He's going to continue with the life that he has because he's happier than he ever was at Kern. Even though he was on the High Council, he was the captain of a fighting ship. None of that matters. He's going to move on.
Or so he thinks.
And this is the really sad part. He reports to the Gorkon. Everybody's back on board and ready to go. And he goes and he gets called into Clegg's office, where Clegg gets up from behind the desk and proceeds to tell him to get off his ship.
Well, he did challenge the captain.
Well, and even that isn't even the entire reason. The reason that Clegg threw him off the ship is because Rodek betrayed him. He sat down at that restaurant with Doric, believed everything Doric said, full well knowing the relationship between Clegg and Doric, how Clegg discommodated him, threw him out of the house for being a dishonorable liar, and instead of siding with his captain like he should have, he turned around, bought everything that Doric sold him, and betrayed his captain and was ready to kill him in battle if he could. And so Clegg tells him, I can never trust you again. Get off my ship. He is very fortunate that Clegg didn't just run him through.
Well, it amounts to the same thing, because I believe at the end of the story, Kern cannot now find another ship to serve on.
The only way he would find another ship to serve on is if he manages to get on with an enemy of Clegg or someone who doesn't really care. But being thrown off of a ship, being thrown out of a crew for betraying your captain apparently is a very big black mark on your record, and you're not likely going to find another position. So
everything that made him happy is gone because of his trusting the wrong guy.
It's really sad, because I did not remember that this had happened the first time I read it, and Kern was one of my favorite characters in Next Generation and Deep Space Nine, and this is a bad ending for someone.
Kern really never had a lot of control over his life because he was the second son of Moog.
We get to this last conference with Martok, and this is where everything comes together. Okay, Korak is given control of her house, and I mentioned earlier what happened between her and Leskit, Clegg and Borak. Once again, Clegg is validated completely by Martok. Martok backs up everything he does or has done, and has him continue. Borak is told that the old medical group that she was at the conference for has been dissolved, and they're making up a new one, the Klingon Medical Authority. I think that's what it's called. And she is not going to be the head of it, which she doesn't understand why. But Martok knows how the other doctors in the Klingon Empire feel about her. And so in order to get them on board with it, he's not going to allow her to be in charge of it. However, two doctors that helped her with that crash on Kronos will be heading it up. And Borak also reports that the pilot was not behaving dishonorably. He did not intentionally crash that shuttle into that building, but he had an aneurysm, which the Klingon doctor, or the other Klingon doctor, had determined that he hit his head and that he had gone a little off kilter, and that's why he decided to crash this shuttle in there. And he was already dead when the shuttle crashed because of the aneurysms. So Borak has now justified her methods of medicine for everyone.
There's so much in this book, isn't there?
Oh yeah, there's tons. Okay, and then we get the two epilogues. The first epilogue shows Bael working at the embassy for a guy who likes to repeat himself a lot with his instructions to her. She gets frustrated by this, and she tells Worf about it, and Worf says, yeah, I know how he is, just do what he says, and everything will be fine. And Worf has taken her to the opera performance, okay? And she still sees that, well, in her own mind, that she has a chance with Worf for those two to get together. And Worf tells her, I've got to go here, I've got to go there, I have these duties to perform, I have those duties to perform, I will see you when I get back, and who knows where that's going to go.
Well, actually, we do, because we've read the trilogy earlier, I believe it's called Prey, where Worf ends up as first officer of the Enterprise.
And Bael is not in the picture anymore.
At all. But that's another author's thing.
Right. Now, I don't know about you, but the relationship between Worf and Bael kind of bothered me anyway. I don't know, maybe I'm just old-fashioned, but there seemed to be a very, very large age gap between the two of them on Korea, where she was not even of adult age yet.
Jim, it's not that you're really, really old-fashioned, because really, really old-fashioned was... there was a 20-year age gap between a man and a woman in a marriage.
Okay. So, yeah, I, and even in this book, I felt very uncomfortable with her pining after Worf, you know, but in any case.
First love, you know, first crush, first infatuation. She's never been exposed to other guys. This will change as she makes new friends.
Well, and then there was talk. I thought those two might get together at some point because they are the same age.
But they've been raised together, and you really don't see a lot of romances going that way, except maybe out in the country. But, you know, they're being introduced to the big city. Talk in particular is being introduced to the Klingon Defense Force and all the things that go along with that. And now she's being introduced, even if she doesn't get out in the city, she's being introduced to Federation diplomacy in the embassy on Kronos.
I think it's going to be very difficult for her to climb up the ladder, though. You know, perhaps we're moving towards her becoming an ambassador herself, maybe when Worf leaves.
No. We know who takes over.
Right.
Alexander.
Alexander does. However, you know, her becoming a high official, especially in the Klingon Empire, is not going to happen because she is half Romulan.
But there are all kinds of other things. There is, if nothing else, opera, entertainment. Being a performer. No, there are all kinds of avenues open to her that she's never been able to explore.
So I don't know. Maybe an author can mention her somewhere in a book. Maybe her and Worf can have Ractigino together sometime and get caught up on their lives. Who knows?
I think you mean prune juice.
Okay. That's funny.
You remember Worf's into prune juice.
Oh, yes. I know that very well. So, after all of that, I mean, and this is all packed into...
There's a lot of that.
Yeah. It's all packed into a single book. I mean, I think it's taken me longer to explain it than it did for me to read it.
No, it took me a lot longer to read it than to try and explain half of it. You know, it's just, it is a very dense book with a lot of details that you really want to chew on for a long period of time, because they make a lot of sense and flesh out Klingon culture.
So were you able to pick out a favorite point of plot in this at all?
Not particularly, no. I mean, it's just, to have picked out a favorite point of plot would have denigrated everything else, and there really wasn't anything wrong. The only one that I had a little bit of a problem with was Kenla. But then that's only because you're supposed to not like that particular part of the city on Kronos. So even that worked.
Well, you know, for me, overall, I was really fascinated with the diversity of the crew and their lives outside of the Klingon Defense Force. I don't think we've ever gotten a really good picture of what life on Kronos is about before this book.
Except through the eyes of Worf, and that was it. He's not a member of Klingon society. He's a outsider to Klingon society. So yeah, the fact that you've got all of these different points of view showing you what it's like in Klingon society is really intriguing.
Yes, and another good source of this is Dayton Ward's travel guide on Kronos. I highly recommend that one too to fill in some gaps. I think I enjoyed Wool's Tale the best here, especially the plot twist with Goron, who married Kagak's sister, allowing him to compete and win the fight at the festival on Faven 3. I was pleased with how Wool enjoyed her time on leave and now feels like a part of Kagak's family, since she has been lamenting the loss of her own family through all the books that we've read so far in this series.
Especially since Goron went into that trip not even thinking about a relationship.
Yeah, it was as much a surprise to him as it was to me. You know, the Rodek Kern story made me sad. I don't know if it's because of Tony Todd or the way the episodes were written for the TV series, but he has been so displaced most of his life as Kern or Rodek. And when he made the decision to continue his life as Rodek, it was a little bit of a silver lining. But, you know, he said he was happier than when he was Kern, but his happiness wasn't going to last because he got thrown off the ship for cavorting with Doric against Clegg. And he has no place to go now, which is really sad.
I think the biggest problem with Kern is the fact that he is the second son of Moog. But as far as Klingon society is concerned, he was the head of the House of Moog when he could, and the eldest son because Worf wasn't there. But still having to honor and live up to Worf's expectations, which he may or may not have known what they were.
So let's move on and talk about some of the themes that we found here. You have quite an extensive list.
A lot of stories.
Yeah, a lot of stories and a lot of themes. How about trust?
Yeah. I can understand why Kern believed Doric when Doric came to him with the information. He was already massively confused. All the doctors he'd gone to talk to had thrown different things at him that he couldn't quite understand until Doric comes along and weaves a tale that kind of gives him some clarity, even though it's not really true. So he's confused, but being a Klingon, he's got to make a choice and do something about it.
Well, and he didn't take time to think, and it got him in a lot of trouble.
Well, yeah, he was, like I said, he was confused, and the first idea that made sense, he glommed onto and ran with the traditional Klingon way. But you're right, if he'd have just thought things through, he'd have been okay.
And, you know, as it is, he should have trusted his captain. I mean, for crying out loud, he was second officer on the Gorkon. He was the head gunner on the Gorkon. And his captain had proven himself honorable over and over and over again. And Doric had proven himself to be dishonorable over and over and over again. But he went along with Doric, which, you know, he got what he deserved.
Remember, though, Rodak was the second officer of the Gorkon. Rodak was the one who trusted Clagg with his life. Kern slash Rodak, runs into Doric now, and he's so mentally confused as to what is real and what isn't that he can believe the story. I'm not saying he should believe the story, but he's confused enough that he will believe the story.
And another one here is, what makes a good opera versus real life? And another thing that would go along with that, which I think I'll bounce off of you, is this. Here we are in the city of Krenla putting together an opera that is going to attract the attention of the Chancellor of the High Council and counselors and an ambassador and their guests to come to the poorest city on the planet to see an opera.
Yeah. What does that say about opera? In our culture, opera is the highest of the art forms. You know, it's always in the most palatial of settings. Here, opera is brought to the people. It's like, I almost envision this production of the opera to be what I've seen in all the tales of a William Shakespeare production back in his time. More for the people, less for the nobility. You may have the queen show up for a Shakespeare opera, or excuse me, a Shakespeare performance, but it's set in an area where the everyday person would come. And I believe, didn't they even have to stand for the opera? They didn't have enough room in the auditorium for seats.
Yeah, it just depends on whose opera it was. I mean, a Rossini performance could attract a lot of people.
By then, though, Rossini's time, opera had become the higher art form. See, I'm thinking Klingon opera is on the same row as Shakespeare's plays in the time of Shakespeare.
And it depends on the context of what you're looking at. Usually with old opera, long time ago, the opera actually started in Florence, thanks to the de' Medicis in northern Italy, that they wanted to have something that was a heightened art form, and they came up with the idea for opera because it incorporates all of the arts at that time. And it was only intended for the very rich, because the de' Medici family, of course, is known for their banking, their commerce, and being very influential politically, so forth and so on. So it wasn't intended for common people, and it didn't really become something that the common people could consume until actually after Mozart.
So that's why I think that Klingon opera is set up more for the masses than for Klingon nobility. And when you do that, look at how much stories change, how much movies veer from reality to entertain the massive moviegoer that goes to it today.
And that's just it, you know. It was a type of entertainment. It has been throughout history, and now it's considered to be very highbrow. Again, to go to an opera, almost anybody can afford to go to one, but it's hard to get anyone to go. How about, let's move on to another theme, the power of the Chancellor.
Yeah, I know they delineated the Emperor from the Chancellor in the Next Generation episodes, but what is the power of the Chancellor? How much can he decree, and it therefore is? How much does the council have to vote on something to make the decision stick? It sounds like in most everything we're dealing with in Klingon culture, the Chancellor is the one that makes the decisions. You got to wonder what the rest of the council is even there for sometimes.
Well, you know, the thing is we get a pretty good picture in this book of exactly how far Martok can go as Chancellor. So, yes, he gave a special dispensation to Kurak to run her house. However, he wants to change this so a woman can run her house when the situation comes up and she becomes head of the house without having to go and petition the council to do this. So he can grant special dispensation, but he cannot change the rules because the other counselors, who of course are from houses on the planet, they are completely against the change. So he can only go so far with his rulings.
We saw Kempek make the same decision in the DS9 episode, The House of Quark.
No, that was Gowron that made that decision.
Oh, okay. It was Gowron. But you had another chancellor making a similar decision for the same reasons.
So, you know, when you become a politician, you can promise anything you want to promise, but delivering on that promise is not solely up to the person who's making the promise.
That's what a politician is supposed to do. Negotiate his way around the others and bring everybody to the same conclusion that he wanted.
So we talked about love and marriage in the Klingon Empire, and we've talked about Goron and the contest.
Yeah, but the question I brought up is a contest really a contest if the same person wins over and over and over again? When does the Tour de France stop being a bicycle race after Lance Armstrong wins year after year after year?
Probably when he gets caught using steroids.
Well, in this case, I don't think either contestant in the strongman contest in this book were using steroids, but you still got that situation. The various houses were almost afraid to put up a competitor against the guy because they knew he was just going to tear their competitors apart.
Well, for a lot of people, it was easy money because it was the gaming that was going on the side. You know, nobody was going to bet against the champion, but they might bet on how long the opponent is going to last against that champion.
I think we even had some discussion in Korak's house about the survivability of Kurak having to go in and face this guy versus his bigger, larger, sturdier brother who was now enfeebled and couldn't do it.
Well, and there was no guarantee that Furman was going to win either.
He's probably going to lose too, but he wasn't going to get hurt.
Out of the whole family, he had the best chance of winning. What they didn't count on was Goron walking in. We know Goron very well because we've been reading about him for, well, this is our fourth book where we've been watching him. We know who's going to win going in. I mean, if there was anything in this book that was predictable, you knew Goron, once he stepped into the circle, he was going to dominate, and he certainly did.
Yeah, but I think the point is, the concept here is, if you know the outcome before it begins. Is it really a contest?
Okay. Well, I would say no, if you know. However, they weren't counting on someone better entering the contest.
You knew something like that was going to happen, but for the 4 years preceding this, you had the situation where one guy was going to dominate.
So maybe there's always those that are holding out hope that a new champion will come along.
In most works of, in most movies at least, which you've got the situation of the guy who's going to win ends up being an underdog because, well, do movie audiences really want to see somebody who's uber matched for the contest they're going into and just walk up, boom, win? In real life, that probably happens more than we'd like to think. But in fiction, we really don't want to see just massive abilities. I don't want to say massive abilities because that implies some sort of skill level. But massive physical talents that just overwhelm everybody else.
Well, yeah, it's not intriguing at all if you know what's going to happen before it happens, you know. But then you get a situation with, you know, like the Rocky movies. All of Rocky's opponents were big, huge, overpowering people. You know, Ivan Drago, he was just absolutely unbeatable, but Rocky beat him.
Except for Apollo Creed, who was skillful.
Well, that's because...
And that became, that became the interesting fights, because the two were very evenly matched.
So, that's about it. You know, any closing thoughts?
I don't know. When we gotta rope down to Rocky, we're dragging the barrel here.
Yeah. So yeah, and you have any? Are there any closing thoughts you have?
Well, like we said earlier, it's too bad that pocketbooks pull the plug on Keith. There's so much more that he knows about Klingon culture. Granted, he's probably made it up, but there's so much more out there that he could tell us in his stories that it would be interesting to see these stories keep coming.
I have to agree. It's a tragedy we don't have more stories following the Gorkon. You know, it was really fun to watch these characters grow through the stories in the trilogy and to get to know them better as individuals in this one. And hopefully one day we will get something.
You know, a thought occurred to me just now. We got to see these characters grow more and understand these characters a lot more than we did the 7 years the Next Generation was on the air.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, these are characters that actually came very much to life, at least for me.
So that's what happens when you're reading a book versus watching a TV episode. You can't really get in the mind of the character in a TV presentation the way you can as an author digs into the characters' minds.
It's so true.
So read, people, read.
Yes, and read along with us, because next month we're going to take an interesting tack, I think, and we're going to be looking at Star Trek, the animated series, Log 7, a story called The Counterclock Incident, and this is written by Alan Dean Foster, based on a story that was the very last episode of Star Trek, the animated series.
But interestingly enough, that's only like the first third of the book.
Nope. Spoiler alert.
There's a lot more to the book than just the one TV episode. So read it.
Yeah, read it along with us and join us next time on Bound by Honor. I am Jajim.
And I am Jorn.
Ka-pa. You have been listening to Bound by Honor, the Klingon Assault Group book review podcast. Bound by Honor is brought to you by the Klingon Assault Group and is produced by Admiral Kirk Zantai Loon Keech. If you hear the call of the warrior, visit our homepage at www.kag.org to learn more about what it means to be Klingon. Perhaps you have what it takes to be one of us. Listener feedback is always welcome at podcast@kag.org. Ka-plop!